Welcome to this session. It's nice to see you all again. I'm back in the ashram at the moment, as you might have guessed by the logo behind me. So today we'll continue with the Bhagavad Gita. First we'll do a meditation because it's coming up to Christmas, and this will be the last session I think this year. So we'll do a Christmas theme. And, you know, I think it's really important for us this time of Christmas. Once we get away from all the noise and the hype, then it's a very uplifting time. So, and then we'll do the Bhagavad Gita. We'll continue with chapter 8, the Akshara Brahma Yoga, which is actually, they're all phenomenal chapters, but that's a very interesting chapter. And I've got a feeling we won't even finish it this time. And as normal, if there's time and I really want to make time, if I don't monopolize all the time at least, then I'd really like your feedback, questions, answers, comments, whatever it may be. So let's just adjust our body so that we are feeling very comfortable. Moving the arms and the legs and your head so that we can sit in one position for a short period of time, maybe 15 minutes, maybe a bit longer. And then when you're ready, close your eyes. Just appreciating this moment. Knowing that this moment is sacred. And feeling the contact of your body with the ground. Knowing that your body is sacred, and the earth, the ground, the chair is also sacred. And indeed, this very moment is sacred. And as explained, albeit very briefly, in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, which we mentioned last time, the Mahayagya, the sacrifice, which really takes us to bhakti yoga, where we sacrifice, we feel, we know, feel that this presence, this conscious presence, is an expression, is directly connected with the greater reality. And in our life, we sacrifice, we dedicate our lives to the reality that underlies everything. And this is not just idle concepts. It's something that's very deep in all of us, because it's our very nature, actually. Our very nature, on the deepest level, is in a direct contact, inseparable contact with the one reality that underlies everything. So Christmas is a time of sharing. And I think, let us think in this very moment, think of your friends and family and send them good wishes. May they have a wonderful Christmas. And beside all the good food, etc., which is great, and maybe a bit of alcohol, that we find time to really just be and to appreciate each other. So send your best wishes and even mental hugs to the members of your family, friends, one after the other. Just try to visualize them or think of them and send them your love and regards and best wishes. And of course, Christmas is a time of great symbolism. And for me, at least, it may not be everyone's opinion, but Jesus Christ, is a symbol of what is possible in our own lives, where there is direct contact with God, reality, the divine, call it what you wish, and where we can realize this biblical statement, I and my Father are one. So let Jesus be an inspiration and a symbol of the potential that is inherent, or the reality that is inherent in all of us. And during this build-up to Christmas, and during Christmas, and after Christmas, let us take a little bit of time, or more time, where we can reflect on this Mahavakya, great saying, I and my Father are one. What does it mean, actually? And let us also reach out during this time to those who are suffering. Reach out in our hearts, reach out with gestures and practical help or a kind word. I think this is an important part of Christmas. So even now in your mind, reach out to those people who you know to be suffering in some way. And Christmas is a season of goodwill. So even think of those people who you don't like very much or who've hurt you in some way. And send them also goodwill. So let us transform this festive period into a sacred time. A time when we can reconnect with our spiritual roots. And send peace and goodwill to those parts of the world where there is strife, where there is war. Know that the reality of our being, of our existence, is far greater, actually, is beyond any definitions, any concepts. Beyond the mind and the body. Knowing that this body and mind is an expression of reality, this indefinable, ineffable reality. And slowly, in your own time, you can start to extrovert. You can, of course, keep your eyes closed throughout. I have no objections. Or you can open them slowly. Bringing yourself in contact with the external world. So, last time we looked into the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, and actually we didn't get very far. The verses were so dense, I didn't feel we could skip. But as I just said earlier on, that applies to all of the chapters and every verse, to be honest. So in the chapter 8, Akshara Brahma Yogaha, the yoga of the imperishable, immutable reality. Highfalutin statement, but the chapter is actually quite extraordinary. Let's just recap, because Arjuna asks a few questions about certain words, certain concepts, such as Brahman. He's asking Krishna to give him some ideas, guidance on the meaning of Brahman, reality, Adhyatma, karma, Adhibhuta, Adhideva, Adhiyagya, and what is the best practice to know one's spiritual identity at the time of death. So they're all questions which are packed in to the first two verses. So just to recap, Brahman is indefinable, of course, it's reality, totally beyond our concepts, but accessible to our consciousness, actually. This is the extraordinary thing. May not be accessible to our thinking, may not be accessible to our concepts, but it is accessible to our conscious presence. Not definable, but accessible, realizable. And then in the later verses, of course, Krishna defines these concepts. Adhyatma, he defines as the Atma, the individual consciousness in each living creature. Conscious presence, if you wish. And karma, and this is the interesting thing, he doesn't say it's our karma. We get very much into this idea, it's my karma, your karma, and all the rest of it. But actually, it's not correct. Because in this chapter, in this one of these first verses, I think it's the third or fourth verse, Krishna says, the process which manifests all these creatures and makes them act, that is karma. So to say it's my karma, your karma, it's not strictly correct, not from a deeper understanding. Yeah, we can say, yes, my karma to have, you know, a certain body, to be a male, female, to be born in a certain country, to practice yoga, etc., etc. Yeah, in a sense, but it's superficial. The karma doesn't belong to us. It belongs to reality, if you wish. And karma is a means by which all creatures are manifested and through which they act. I mean, it's a totally different definition. For me, I mean, this shows a completely different slant on the meaning of karma. Yeah, there's other definitions to karma, law of cause and effect, and karma means actions, work. Yeah, there's all these different definitions. But in this context here, Adibhuta is the perishable body, this thing that you see in front of you, which is your body, my body. This is the defined in Sanskrit as the Adibhuta, the perishable body of all things. It comes out of this one reality, actually. Adideva, which is the vital energy, mind, that which gives energy, life. Yeah, actually, it's that which gives life. Prana, in another context, we would call it prana. It's that which gives life to what would be otherwise not able to do anything. It's the vital force, the mind, which acts through all of us. This is defined as Adideva. Adiyagya is also defined. And it is, you know, there are many different forms of yagya, havan, all these kind of things, sacrifice, and they're very powerful. There was one here yesterday in the ashram, and it was bitterly cold. People were sitting outside, but the fire was going, but it created, despite the fact that it was cold and outside, it created a very tangible vibration in the ashram. So we don't need to diminish the importance of yagya. But the definition, according to this chapter 8, given by Krishna, is that it is really the knowing. It is the knowing of the conscious presence to the wider reality. Dedicating one's, as I explained earlier on in the meditation, dedicating one's being or consciousness to the wider reality. That is yagya, sacrificing it. And as I explained last time, the word sacrifice corresponds with the word sacred. And someone sent me some definitions of it. And the person is sitting here on the screen, I think. But that's basically it. Knowing this adiyagya, dedicating oneself to the wider reality, indefinable. That is the real, not the real, it is the deepest sacrifice. And from that, we realize that everything is sacred. Even things that we don't like and the horrible things that we read about in the news, which we find, I certainly do, almost unacceptable. And you think, what is going on there? And some of us may even get angry with God from time to time. You know, what the hell is he, she, it doing? But it's sacred. It is sacred. Despite everything, we don't understand it. That's for sure. How can we understand when there's so much suffering, people killing each other? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. We don't understand it. But on the deepest level, it is all sacred. And then Krishna went on to the subject of what to do at death. So now I'm looking at the Bhagavad Gita, the chapter. And he said in verse number 5, and those who've got the text may see it, the wording may be different in your translation, but it is as follows. Those who remember me, and me can be two things. It can be a concept or an image. And I suppose in this Christmas time for Christians, it would be Christ, Jesus. For other religions, it would be, well, in Hinduism, of course, it would be Krishna, no question. In Buddhism, probably Buddha. But it may not be a form. You know, it could be a form is easier for most of us. I mean, that's absolutely sure. But it may not be a form. It may be just the spaciousness that I talk about so much, and which is such an important part of the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, this sense of spaciousness. So ideally, I mean, because if we're living in physical pain, it's not easy, I'm sure. But we assume that someone is dying, they've had a good life, and certainly followed some spiritual path, be it yoga or any other path. And therefore, they know without doubt that there is a greater reality underlying each of us and all things, in fact. So those who remember me at the time of death will come to me. Do not doubt this. So as I say, it's two things. You can make it form. And in Sanskrit, this is called sakara, with form. Or it can be nirakara, without form. It's entirely up to you. Form is easier for most people. You have a particular form which you've kind of dedicated yourself to in your life. It can be anything. It can be in India, there's so many goddesses also, Kali, Lakshmi, and so forth. Whatever touches you, then you can use that form to meditate at the time of death. But if, and this would be certainly an Advaitic viewpoint, which I subscribe to, no question, that it can be formless. So you go into that spaciousness. And in a later chapter, a later verse, Krishna says, chant Om. It's another one. As you die, hopefully, this is the ideal situation. It may not be quite as nice as this. But let's take the ideal situation. So you chant Om, and I say it's mentioned in a later verse, chanting Om, 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 and being submerged in that vibration. And it can be any other mantra again. I guess Om is easier. Can't be a long drawn out mantra when you're on the, you know, the edge of death. You can't, you know, start, well, maybe you can, but start chanting a 500 verse mantra. Om is simple and focused, and it's been used by people worldwide. Well, in India for thousands of years, and now worldwide, that's for sure. Can be Om. It can be any other mantra. It needn't be Sanskrit, actually. My personal mantra, funnily enough, is not Sanskrit. So it can be, it doesn't need to be Sanskrit. I think Sanskrit is great. There are fantastic vibrations, and it's a holy language in the sense that it's been dedicated for thousands of years to those people who have followed a spiritual path. So it's got very, very powerful connotations and very powerful vibrations also. But it can be Om, it can be any other mantra, can be a non-Sanskrit mantra, whatever occupies your attention now when you're meditating. Because also, let's remember, you don't need to wait until you're on the edge of death. You don't need to wait until you're on the threshold of death. We can go to that point, not by dying, but through meditation. And in meditation, when it goes deeper, spontaneously, you can't create it. It just happens. There is a dying, in a sense, in inverted commas. There is a dying of the ego. The ego dissolves. So that's a form of dying, actually. It's dying before we die. And many of the mystics, Christian mystics and Hindu mystics and Buddhist mystics have said this, actually. To die before you die, and the senses go into this meditative state where the ego dissolves, and that's that. We are in then the conscious presence. We identify then. with conscious presence. So it needn't be when we die. I mean, in this verse, Krishna's talking about the point of death, because Arjuna asked in the first verse, he asked the question, what to do, or second verse, what to do at the time of death. And so Krishna's answering that question. So ideally, that's it. If we have some form that draws us, to which we are attracted, then we can use that form. It can be a mantra. We chant Om mentally, aloud, whatever, or any other short mantra. Need not be Sanskrit. Or from the Advaitic perspective, you go into that spaciousness and you identify with conscious presence. So that's the stuff that this is the advice that Krishna has given. I've elaborated, of course, as I as I tend to, but the words are as follows: those who remember me at the time of death, me being in this case Krishna, but in your life it may be another form, or it may be the formless. So those who remember me at the time of death will come to me. Come to me, it doesn't mean you go to somewhere on the other side of the universe. No, it means that your identification gets submerged in the reality of consciousness, actually. Do not doubt this. This is what Krishna says here. Do not doubt this. So anyway, doubt is a good thing, as I've said many times, because doubt makes a search. But at the time of death, you haven't got time to start doubting this and that. It's best to be totally absorbed in that moment. And if you're in that moment also, that's enough. If you are really totally identified with the moment, that moment, that is also enough. Automatically, you will be submerged, absorbed, identified with consciousness. So a lot in there. And then I left, and that's where I got last time, actually. I'm still repeating stuff in a bit more detail, perhaps, that we got to last time. And then we came to the verse 6, which goes as follows. Whatever occupies your mind at the time of death determines your direction and destination. Again, there's two interpretations of this. First interpretation, which I actually prefer, and that's what I've just said. What is occupying your mind at the point of death, if it is, you know, some form, that form will take you in to the reality behind that form. Because, you know, when we have these icons, whether it's Christ, Krishna, Rama, the Devas, Kali, Durga, Lakshmi, so many others, you know, there is a reality behind those forms, actually. The form is the surface. Those forms can take us into the reality which underlies those forms. So at the time of death, whatever occupies our mind, and as I said, I've just said, if you are spacious, then that spaciousness will take you into that realization. So it's the form that we identify with. If it's a form, that form has the capacity of taking us at the time of death, even in our meditation, to that which lies behind that form. There's only one thing lying behind those forms. There's only one reality behind all these different forms. And if we are in it, it can take us to realization of that identity. And as I said, if we identify with spaciousness or Om or some mantra, it has the same function, actually. Or, and this is where we get into muddy waters, but I do, more and more I think there is a reality behind this, that whatever is in our mind, if we haven't done much, any inner work, then our mind may be full of stuff. So we may be really wishing we weren't dying, of course. I mean, that's quite a strong word, no question. And we may be identifying with something, with our personality, and we may feel regret. And these are things that can happen as we die, even though it's, you know, our last moment on planet Earth. There may be other things which are whirling around the mind. So the proposition, and I think there's a lot of truth in it actually, but, you know, that where you think, where your aspiration is at the time of death, takes you to the realm of the Akashic records, where whatever functions in relation to that thought or feeling or whatever it is, then it kind of takes root. And maybe in the future, sometime in the future, may not be immediately, it can re-manifest, not as you. I don't believe that. But I do say there is something in the Akashic records that takes root of your last wish or your last aspiration when you die. And of course, this brings in the concept of rebirth, reincarnation, and so forth. But I don't believe, actually, personally, you have your own belief. I think reality is far beyond these concepts. But, you know, the belief that you will be reborn as another form, another being, perhaps, another human, perhaps. But then it's not you that's reborn. The you that is the ego is not reborn. It may be another entity, another form, but it's not the ego personality that we identify with at this moment. No. Other forms may take place, but it is not you that is being reborn or reincarnated. There are processes, of course, as I'm trying to illustrate, not very elegantly, I must say. There are processes in the collective unconscious, in the Akashic records, in the cosmic mind, call it what you wish. And from there, these patterns will manifest. So, yeah, that's the thinking. There's two, and later on in this chapter, actually, they talk about the dark movement of the moon and the light movement, something like that. And that's exactly what's being indicated here. Either you follow the path of light, which is what is indicated here, or you follow the path of the dark moon. I'll have a look in a minute. It's something like that. I've got the quotation wrong. And then we are then plunged into the identification of our individuality. And that goes in to the collective unconscious, Akashic records, cosmic mind, whatever you wish to call it. So it's a bit theoretical. I do know from my own experience that there are incredible forces which are below the surface of material existence. You know, mental forces, emotional forces, psychic forces, unimaginable. So, and we can't capture what goes on there with our concepts. And I'm sure many of you have had profound experiences where you, at the end, you know, you think, well, what was that all about? And you can't explain it. Even dreams. I mean, I always come back to dreams because that's something that's tangible. And we all have dreams. And many times you go into a dream. And if you remember, you think, what was that about? You know, you're meeting all these strange people and the strange things going on. Where does it all come from? So that's an indication of the incredible, almost infinite, probably infinite processes that are going on below the surface of our personality, below the surface of what we would call the subconscious. So there we are. So in the next verse, Krishna says, therefore, at all times, remember me only and fight. This is the concept. This is the context of the Bhagavad Gita. We don't need to get out and fight, hopefully. And I've been lucky in my life. I've never been in a war. And probably that's the same with most of you here. But fight here means get on with your life, actually. You know, I could, in the context of a Bhagavad Gita, Krishna was saying to Arjuna, you don't have a choice. Not really. Get out there and do what you have to do as a soldier, as a warrior. But we can take that in our lives and say, therefore, at all times, remember me only and live your life. Whatever your life is, how it's going, with all its ups and downs. Yes, of course, we have to deal as well as best as we can and as compassionately, I would say from a spiritual perspective also, as compassionately as we can, you know, with our lives, with people. But within that, try more and more to bring this remembrance of the ineffable reality that underlies every moment of our lives. So this is the advice Krishna gives. And he carries on in verse 7. This is, with the mind and intellect fixed or absorbed in me, you will certainly come to me alone. So you're not saying duck out on our life, go and live in a cave. No, nothing's being said here. We get on with our lives, but we try and deepen our understanding, our spiritual understanding, actually. Yeah, understanding generally. Try and, in our lives, whatever it is, getting on with what we have to do, doing our duty, but trying, you know, through practice, our daily practice, whatever it may be, asana, pranayama, mudra, mantra, meditation, whatever it may be, trying to deepen our inner understanding. And of course, not only that, and having this depth and openness and compassion or whatever it is in the morning practice, but bringing that into life. There's no point in behaving like a saint when we do our practice and behaving like a monster in our daily affairs. No, I'm not saying we have to become false saintly in our daily lives, but trying to bring what we have experienced in our morning practice or whenever it is, or what is being said here in this text and which is said in many other texts. Many other texts. India has an enormous number of extraordinary texts, as you well know. And there are other texts in other parts of the world too, which are extraordinary, actually. If we go deep into them, we will see that they are giving us a message. And one of the messages is this, which is expressly put here in the Bhagavad Gita. Get on with our lives, but trying to bring this heart-centered, conscious attitude to what we are living, what we are doing. And as I always say, because we do have differences of opinion, that's just the way it is, and sometimes we don't like people, sometimes we fight with people, that's okay. But even when you're fighting with someone and disagreeing with someone, and you think someone is a whatever you want to put there, still knowing that they are part of this kaleidoscope of life, of existence. So don't pretend that you are, you know, yes, I'm always peaceful and I'm always loving. And I know that's, I don't think that's true. And maybe one or two of you there, but I don't think so. I'd be very surprised. No, let's be honest. That's sincerity, honesty is fundamental, actually. And so it goes on. I think I'm going to stop it there because, and I'll continue. It won't be this year, but we'll continue with that part. Because then it goes into the yugas, the eras of time, which are quite fascinating, actually. And I mentioned them a few times. And the reason that they are important, not that we understand these different eras of time, the Kali Yuga and the Dwapara Yuga and Treta Yuga and Krita Satya Yuga. No, there's some great theories, fantastic theories, which I can quite easily buy into. The main thing I think about these yugas, it puts into perspective how important we take this particular era. You know, everything's changing. So, you know, it just brings in the beauty of the yugas, these eras mentioned later on, and they're enormous. What they're indicating is absolutely enormous in span, time span, is that it brings things into perspective so that we take our life deadly seriously. We're not copping out. We're living our lives, doing what we have to do, but in an inner sense, which we can perhaps tune into in our meditation, we realize it's just a little bubble in the ocean of eternity. And this is extraordinary. And not something we should get depressed about. It's something we should celebrate. Because what we are as conscious presence is not in time. It is outside of time. That's the important thing to at least accept intellectually, theoretically, but even better, to get that understanding in the no thinking meditative state. So we'll talk about the yugas next time, next year. And I guess there's going to be a yuga between now and next year when we get together. Let's celebrate Christmas and help other people celebrate Christmas. Let's connect with the essence of Christmas. Let's connect with others, help others, share with others, feel compassion for those who are suffering. So that's the Bhagavad Gita for the moment. We'll come back to it next year. Otherwise, as is always the case, I've monopolized too much time. I'm sorry about that. So are there any questions? If so, raise your hands, or any comments, questions, observations, answers. If so, put up your hand and Emily will let you in. Are you there, Emily?
Hi, I'm here. Right. I don't know, last time we popped the questions in the chat, so if people want to do that, I'm very happy to read them out again.
Okay, that's work? A good idea. Yeah.
Okay, so I've just got a message from Dave Whitby who says, this ties in so well with one of my favorite quotes from Einstein on the death of a friend. He has left this strange world a little before me. This means nothing. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction made between past, present, and future is nothing more than a persistent, stubborn illusion.
Beautiful. Absolutely fantastic. And I think, as I've always said, when a person goes deep into science, or art or anything, it can reveal that kind of understanding. And of course, it's written in the equations, you know, it's according to Einstein. I mean, time is not real, actually. And if time is not real, it kind of reinforces what is being said here in the Bhagavad Gita and in all the sacred holy texts. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, any more questions?
Nothing currently, but we can wait a second, see if anything comes through.
Let me read that quote again, because it's so
Good. So the quote from Einstein on the death of a friend is, "He has left this strange world a little before me. This means nothing. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction made between past, present, and future is nothing more than a persistent, stubborn illusion."
Beautiful. And I think that maybe that's the attitude we should all have. You know, if we lose a dear one, you know, a family member or friend or whatever, we have this attitude. Yeah, we grieve. Grief is a normal thing, human thing, of course. Well, not only human, animals seem to grieve also, to be honest. But, you know, we grieve, but then have this philosophical, more spiritual, I would say, deeper understanding that has been expressed here, you know, by Einstein. Well, everyone's really quiet, so I guess it's touched us somewhere.
Okay, so we've just got a few more coming through. Okay. So this is Mike. He says, "This is my first time here. Many thanks and blessings. Brahman is the remembrance that you refer to that I hold on to in meditation. My question is how best to find routine in meditation whilst in the midst of busy life."
Yeah, it's a good question, because a practical question, because life is getting busier and busier. And I kind of talked about this, Mike, at another time, but there's no harm in repeating it. Life is getting faster and faster. And I don't know whether we can keep up with this increasing acceleration of things to do. we try, but, you know, it's not easy. So I think point one, as much as is possible, try and simplify, to at least cut out the clutter in our lives. And I don't mean only physical clutter, the things which actually are not necessary. So in my life, you know, I look at some of these things on the internet, and then I realize that most of them actually, it's all interesting. It's kind of nourishes the intellect, but on a deeper level, it is not really deepening the quality of my life. So making decisions, you know, what do we want to fill our mind with? What do we want to fill our life with? Making, and we have to, otherwise if we try and follow everything that we should do or we think we should do, then we'll go nuts. Absolutely. We'll just I can't think what will happen. We have to simplify as much as possible our life, even cutting out those things which may be nourishing for our mind, but which ultimately are not very important. I mean, there's so much we can know. We have this internet. We can know what's going on in every nook and corner of this planet. And it's all fantastic stuff. But I think at a certain point, we have to discriminate. And of course, this is an important concept in yoga, viveka, discrimination. Discriminate those things which are not really useful in the quality of my life and which do not allow me time, which is most important, to practice. Practice may be just sitting quietly by yourself, eyes closed, eyes open, just being in the moment. Or it can be, as we know very well, it can be asana, pranayama, mudra, bandha, mantra, meditation, all these kind of things, you know. So the important thing is to dedicate some time every day to practice. And many people say, well, I haven't got time for practice, I'm too busy. That may be there, but I still think everyone, even the most busy person, can at least put aside some time every day. And it's got to be quality time. No point sitting down with your television going full whack or full speed or your internet connections all going. No, it means you switch everything off. No phone, deconnect the phone or something. You know, it means quality time. Everyone can find some time. Some people, you know, can find a few hours. Not many people probably. Some people can find half an hour. Some people can find 20 minutes. Some people 10 minutes. Some people, well, 5 minutes. But just shutting off completely so that you can be in practice. As you said, Mike, reflecting on Brahman in your case. So it's really, it behoves us in the modern world where we are almost obliged or being pulled into being involved in so many, 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 many things. We have to, you know, be involved with the things which are pertinent to our lives. Yeah, we don't need to hide our head in the sand like the ostrich. You know, we need to know what's going on. But, you know, once you know what's going on, the news, 3 minutes, you've got the idea. We don't need to spend hours listening to all these interviews. This person thinks this and that person thinks that, and this is an opinion here and there. You know, the news media is all about hyping up stuff. And instead of just giving us the facts, you know, this is this, this is it, this is going on, ching, 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 3 minutes, by, they carry on into all this detail. Do we want to go into all that detail? Occasionally, yes. All the time, no. So discrimination, Mike, I think is really important. Creating some time in our life so that we can be quiet and deepen, and perhaps even read the Bhagavad Gita or whatever holy sacred text, you know, touches you. So, I mean, that's the best I can say, really. We have to simplify our lives and so that we have more time, according to our situation, to just be or to practice. It's fundamental. Otherwise, we can be busy until our dying day, until the last moment. We're still thinking what's happening in this part of the world and what's going on there and blah, 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 and all this political stuff and this film star's doing this. No. I'm not interested when I die. I'm not interested. But if the mind has been conditioned to be thinking of all this stuff, then that's what will be there probably when you die. I don't know. So that's my simplistic explanation or understanding or advice. Anything else? Any other questions there, Emily?
Yeah, we have one more question from Sue Beaver, who says, how then to continue to relate to those loved ones in our lives who are deeply immersed in what we have decluttered ourselves of? How to find the common ground?
Yeah, that's a difficult one too. It's a good question again, because we may be practicing yoga, but not everyone else is. I mean, our family may not be, some may be. Friends maybe think we're nuts. Why are we wasting our time, you know, practicing yoga when we could be down having fun, you know, going down the pub or whatever is, you know. And we can't convert anyone. I've never seen it's very useful. We can't verbally convert other people into our way of life. We can live our way of life as much as we are able, and it's not always easy. And perhaps people will see, well, actually, this person, you know, my mother, father, friend, sister, daughter, whatever, it, my brother, whatever, seems to be in a good space these days. Why? And then they will think, well, maybe it's because of, you know, yoga or their way of life. Yeah, we can't oblige everyone to follow our path. That doesn't work like that. So it's kind of giving what we need, doing what we need to do. We don't need to reject anyone. We don't need to reject our husband or our wife or our friends because we are now following a spiritual path. But maybe that happens also. You know, it certainly happened in my life. When I was very young, I was with so many friends, and they were certainly not interested in what I was interested in. But automatically, I didn't have to say, well, bye-bye, I don't talk to you anymore. It was natural. It kind of, in the course of time, I didn't have any contact with them, or contact became less. So there's also a natural process where we gravitate more and more to those people who are also following a path of deepening. But no, we shouldn't reject the people of our family or friends or whoever. But, you know, we have to find our own way. Make it really clear. Look, this is what I enjoy doing, and that's it. So we're not rejecting anyone, but we're not allowing other people to dictate how we want to run our life in terms of, you know, yoga and so forth. That's sacred for us. And if people try and, you know, make fun of us and say, why are you wasting your time doing this, sitting with your eyes closed for, you know, every morning? Why don't you do something useful? No, we say, I'm sorry, this is a red line. And it's important for me. I will give that time to my practice. I will, you know, read some of these holy books. You know, you've got to be really clear. And if they don't accept it, then you have to say, yeah, well, sorry, but that's just the way it is. I made this choice. Without getting into the holier-than-thou attitude, that's not useful either. Living our lives, trying to not reject those necessarily who are family, friends, but just making it clear that it's our path. And if they want to join you or blend into the similar path, then that's great. If they don't, that's fine too. Conversion, trying to convert people, doesn't work actually, not in this way. You can rave on about, oh, yoga's fantastic, it's the best thing since the invention of the wheel. But if they're not ready to listen, then it'll just be rejected, or it will go over the top of their head, you know? Don't try and convert anyone. It doesn't work, I don't think. So that's it. I think I wish you certainly a wonderful Christmas. It's a bit early, but it's a good opportunity. And I wish you a wonderful Christmas. May you have fun. May you share with your friends, family. And may you also have the opportunity of deepening into the essential meaning of Christmas. So let's chant Om three times, not because we're dying at the moment. I don't think anyone is dying here on the screen, but let's chant Om. If you want to unmute your mic, you can do so. So let's just be quiet, close the eyes. Appreciating this sharing with other like-minded people. We chant Om three times, breathing deeply. Oh. Oh, oops. May you have a wonderful Christmas. And
Hare Om Swami Dev, Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Swami Nishnath. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thank you, Nadalik Sawan.
Stay well.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Merry Christmas.